And the first one is a report, is number three, a report on the Garcia River Monitoring Program, overview, status, and trends. And we'll call on Jonathan Waterdam and Jennifer Kara of the Nature Conservancy to make a presentation.
Good morning, Chairman Corbett, members of the board. My name is Jonathan Warmerdam. I'm a senior environmental scientist, specialist for your staff. And alongside me is Jennifer Kara, an aquatic ecologist from the Nature Conservancy. Today, we'll be presenting together on the Garcia River Monitoring Program, overview, status, and trends. The topics that we'll be covering, I'll be providing kind of a high-level overview for some context of the watershed, the setting, some of the beneficial uses, a bit of the history of the impairment of this watershed, and then some of the conservation and restoration practices and actions that have been taken to try and recover the watershed. Then I'll turn it over to Jennifer. She will be leading the discussion regarding the Garcia River Monitoring Program and getting into the data and trends, some of the results from our analyses over the different years. And then it'll be turned back over to me for a wrap up with some conclusions and some take home messages, a couple closing thoughts. So first, I'd like to start with our mission statement here for the North Coast Water Board: healthy watersheds, effective regulation, strong partnerships. Ask that you kind of reflect on this a little bit as we're going through the presentation. I think it'll resonate with you that the Garcia provides a good example of exactly this, obtaining our mission statement and implementing it. Also, the Garcia, in a lot of ways, is similar to some of our other North Coast watersheds as far as the land use history and the impacts and impairments that have occurred. Some of the lessons that we've learned and some of the actions that are taken here in the Garcia, I think, can resonate and reflect with other watershed conservation actions elsewhere. So just a little bit on the setting. The Garcia is located in southwest Mendocino County. It is bordered on the west side by Point Arena and the Highway 1. It drains out into the Pacific Ocean just above Point Arena. And then over on the east side is Highway 128 leading up to Boonville. If you look up into the kind of headwaters area where Mill Creek and Partalo Creek come together is actually where the main stem of the Garcia begins, heading in a westerly direction past Lamore Creek, Inman Creek, Signal Creek. Eventually it gets down to where the South Fork comes in. This is where it intercepts the San Andreas Fault Line. This is a really low gradient stretch of the river. Basically, it drops about 10 feet per mile as it heads to the coast. So this is a real depositional zone, an area where we see a lot of the impairment residing still. And that heads down and into the coast. The upper parts of the watershed include a lot of grassland and oak woodland, mixed oak woodland forest. As you head down slope, you enter into the more merchantable timber area of redwood and Douglas fir, but there's other conifers also, hemlock and some pine. And then down in the bottom, we have 12 separate watersheds coming together, sub-watersheds coming together that form the Garcia. They range in size from approximately 3,000 to 6,000 acres. And this is Blue Water Hole right pretty much smack dab in the middle, coming in from your bottom right into the Garcia main stem. This area is primarily, it has conifer, streamside conifer, but mixed in with some hardwoods, alder, willow, etc. The geology of the watershed to the east side of the San Andreas is coastal Franciscan, really erodible, and on the west side of the San Andreas is marine terrace deposits, so the area is really vulnerable to erosion based on any types of land disruption activities. And there's all sorts of aquatic organisms that reside. These are all from the Garcia, things that we've observed over the years. And these are some photos taken by Larry Serpa, a partner from the Nature Conservancy, and Stephen Bargston from our staff. And we have two species of lamprey that are ones shown in the top right, the Western Brook lamprey. We have a bunch of different amphibian species, Western pond turtle in the bottom, et cetera. So a lot of different animals that depend on the health of the watershed. But as you know, there's a lot of focus in particular on the anadromous salmonids that are native to this watershed and elsewhere. Top right, we have Chinook salmon. Bottom left are some coho salmon spawning. And then on the bottom right is a steelhead trout. The decline of those species in particular, we can associate with the last 150 years of different types of land use activity. Going back to the 1860s, shortly after California became the 31st state, was the first industrial timber management that began in the watershed. Here is the mill on the right next to the North Fork of the Garcia. This is about 7 miles up on the main stem. You see there's pretty primitive types of logging at the time. A lot of the streamside conifers were dropped into the watershed and used, the river was used to transport wood to the mills. Here down in the very bottom is a flume that extended from the mill 7 miles down all the way to the coast. It was a way to transport some of the railroad ties and things that were produced at the mill all the way down. There's some old stories, actually, that I found pretty interesting of some youngsters that used to ride some of the ties down this flume. Sounds like it'd be a really exciting way to get down to the coast. This was the era of the splash dam logging period. These were dams that were erected in the rivers and streams. They were impounded with water, and logs were dropped behind them, and then there were kind of released all at once, kind of flushing these logs down the system. It was a really catastrophic period for the rivers. A lot of the large wood that would have resided in the system already, providing structure and function, would be removed just because those were hard points that would contain some of the wood. And so it was a really homogeneous system, really simplified. You can see some oxen team on the top right pulling logs down. And then this was also in the period when the steam donkey on the bottom left was invented, kind of the precursor to our modern cable yarding machinery. And big you know, movements of wood down the system. But it was especially noted that in the post-World War II era was a really damaging period for the Garcia and for most of the North Coast watersheds. This was known as the Golden Era of California. From 1940 to 1970, we had an exploding population. It went from about 7 million people in 1940 to about 20 million in 1970. So there was a lot of demand for log products, wood products. And this was the period when the heavy equipment actually entered the watershed for the first time. The diesel tractors finally had access to the interior. But there weren't any regulations in place, no protections, no Clean Water Act, no forest practice rules. It was basically a liquidation process. I've spoken to you during previous presentations about the ad valorem timber property tax, which actually helped drive some of the liquidation in North Coast forests. In the top middle picture is a photo of Inman Creek. This is one of the most significant tributaries. It was considered a really good coho stream for a long time. Here's a road going right up the belly of it. And these were roads that were constructed almost annually, sediment pushed into them. And then if you had leftover debris and slash, a lot of time you would just throw it into the creeks. So much so that during the 80s, and there was a real big push to clear out a lot of the wood, thinking that we needed to open things up, flush things out. Kind of went too far, apparently, and now we're at a big deficit for wood. And so down on the bottom left is a bridge crossing that led to what's called the Mill D site, which was a big industrial mill in the middle of the watershed. And this was constructed in the 50s. You can see a big teepee burner right here where excess slash was put into there and then burned off. I'll be mentioning that again momentarily. Just to give you a visual representation from an aerial photograph, this is 1952 along the main stem of the Garcia. Kind of point out this shape. It kind of looks like the profile of a face. I'll be going back to that. Up in the top, kind of buried in this wooded area is Inman Creek, and down in the bottom is Signal Creek. This is really untouched. There's nothing, you can't really see anything on this photo that would show that any activities are really occurring. So this was pristine, old growth forest at this point. So in 1952, this is what it looked like. And then moving to 1963, just 11 years later, you can see how much of the landscape has changed. Here again is that kind of face profile. What's more highlighted is this road called the Hollow Tree Road. It still exists today. You can see a lot of different landslides coming off of it into the Garcia. There's skid trail networks all over. This was a really unprecedented and catastrophic period for the Garcia, but also for many North Coast watersheds. This was a really damaging era. Right here, you can actually see the Mill D site, and you can see that teepee burner. There, it's the smokestack is actually burning. You can see the smoke coming off the deck. Pretty intensive period, and this is a period that we're still dealing with today. The impacts of this era have not gone away. When I'm talking about that low gradient stretch of the river along the San Andreas, a lot of the erosion that occurred up here, it's still residing down there. It takes a long time for these systems to continue to recover from them. So here's a survey that was actually done by Fish and Wildlife. There was four different watersheds in California that were assessed during this period to get a representation of how damaged things were getting. And the Garcia was one of those that was actually evaluated by Fish and Wildlife. Another one was Redwood Creek up in the north, the Mequalami River in the Sierra foothills, and then another one up in Siskiyou County on Battle Creek. So this assessment was basically an evaluation of how damaged the system is. And so these red areas are severely damaged stream segments. Yellow is moderately damaged. It's probably best to point out just the blue. These are the only undamaged sections. And so the severely and moderately damaged were 75 to 100% siltation of the stream channel bottom. All the riparian forest was either removed and basically no shelter for fish or other aquatic organisms. So pretty bad period. There was also following that, there was... And preceding that, there's a number of different land use impacts that have been occurring. There was a renewed logging period in the 80s to 90s where 43% of the watershed was logged again. And there's been ongoing agricultural activities, albeit limited to just certain parts of the watershed that have been going on since the 1800s, really. Gravel mining had a little brief period, couple decades, and then there's ongoing cannabis cultivation that rears its head in different parts of the watershed on an annual basis. So the effects, all of this land use history, we have a lot of aggraded stream channels, simplified habitats, finer substrate composition because of all that erosion that's taken place, and turbidity increases. Decreased large wood volumes as we've cleared out the wood that was in the stream channels, but also depleted our riparian forests. We've disrupted kind of the conveyor belt of natural recruitment. And then we have different chemical water chemistry changes and overall degraded biology. So what types of actions are being made to improve the health of the watershed? There's a long history of different types of actions that actually go back to the 50s with the Maillard Ranch Save the Redwoods League, actually establishing the Maillard Reserve. It's an old growth stand that was one of the kind of the first protection actions to take place. From then on, there's been all sorts of private and public actions, including new regulations, local watershed groups, different enhancement plans, et cetera, that have led us all the way to today. Including President Obama's declaration of the lower part of the Garcia as part of the California Coastal National Monument in 2014, which is kind of exciting. And then the other far end of the bookend is Maillard Ranch is again working with Save the Redwoods League right now in negotiation for another conservation easement. They actually own the third largest remaining old growth redwood stand in existence. And so this is behind Humboldt Redwood Company and Mendocino Redwood Company. So it's pretty exciting that some of these old growth forests in the headwaters part of the watershed are going to be protected in perpetuity. I'm pointing out two specific things in bold here, the Garcia TMDL Action Plan, which I will be speaking to very shortly, and then the acquisition of the Garcia River Forest property. This was an acquisition made in 2004 of former industrial timberland. This is the largest property in the watershed. It's approximately 23,000 acres or 23,000 acres. It was an acquisition made by the Conservation Fund. We have a representative here, Scott Kelly, their lead forester for the Conservation Fund. From the Nature Conservancy and Wildlife Conservation Board jointly purchased this former industrial timberland to start managing for a kind of alternative demonstration purposes of sustainable forestry. There's also a ecological reserve. 30% of the property is set aside to manage just towards late cereal habitat to try and reclaim kind of the conditions of the past. As well as all the fish-bearing streams have 200 to 300-foot conservation easements on them. So the action plan for the Garcia River sediment TMDL, since 2004, that was my job. I was the lead staff in the implementation of this new program until a year ago when I received a promotion to kind of work on restoration and permit coordination on behalf of our office. So I've been the lead staff for about a decade. This was the first sediment TMDL with an implementation strategy in history for any place. So this was a big deal, not just for our office, but this was a big deal actually nationwide. This was there was a lawsuit filed against EPA's authority to actually implement non-point source controls under the Clean Water Act through a TMDL that was it was supported that activity is authorized, and so it was adopted into the basin plan and became a new regulation, a new law in 2002. To comply with that, the TMDL provides three separate options. The first is sort of just a default option that you're required to comply with the waste discharge prohibitions that apply, and that's a no controllable discharge standard. Alternatively, and more directed specifically towards the larger landowners, were these two other options, option two and option three. Both of them require development and approval by the executive officer of an erosion control plan. And then also a second component is a series of best management practices to prevent the creation of new sources. And so under option two, a landowner develops a property-specific, site-specific management plan. Under option three, they follow a pre-approved set of BMPs called the Garcia River Management Plan. Also included in the TMDL were a series of numeric targets. These are basically the kind of goal zone that we are aiming for achievement and implementation of the TMDL. And these are set to be achieved by 2049. I don't think I will still be here in 2049. Probably be retired by that point. but somebody will be here and somebody will be looking at whether we, the actions that have been taking place, whether they've been moving in the right direction. And these are all kind of oriented toward the salmonid beneficial use life cycle. Some of these are substrate oriented. Some have to do with in-stream structure or canopy for temperature issues. So the TMDL set the goal of establishing at least one monitoring reach per sub-watershed as a way to evaluate whether we're achieving these targets. But it didn't really specify a specific monitoring protocol to achieve these. These are all kind of distinct parameters that have separate methods for implementation. They're not very cohesive in their implementation. So it kind of posed a challenge for us that Jennifer will be getting into shortly about how we evolved from here to the Garcia River Management Program. This was, like I said, it's sort of the kitchen sink of parameters and numeric targets of the period. And some of these have actually kind of come and gone out of fashion. So I just want to point that out early on before we get into the next part. To date, as far as accomplishments of the TMDL, we're currently working with approximately 80% so far in the watershed of the total acreage. On this left slide, you can see all the area where we're in progress. I consider that quite an accomplishment myself. To be able to partner with this much of a watershed and this many landowners is a real success. And a lot of that, the credit is due to not only the board, but to our executive officers for working with these landowners to come up with approaches that are reasonable and attainable. Out of that, I took some of the results from the top eight largest landowners just to give some statistics on kind of where we're at. Over 300 miles of road have been upgraded so far. 1,800 sediment delivery sites have been treated. 250,000 cubic yards of episodic erosion have been saved, and those are sources associated with kind of catastrophic blowouts from stream crossings or unstable areas. And then 65,000 cubic yards per decade of chronic erosion have been arrested. I'm a bit of a visual learner and a visual teacher, and so I wanted to kind of give a sense of what that actually looks like. If a dump truck holds approximately 10 cubic yards of sediment, so far, we've cut off a valve of about 1,275 dump truck loads per year into the system. That's over 100 of these trucks every year into each of the different sub-watersheds. Pretty significant amount. That's over 50,000 dump truck loads over the life of the TMDL. And there's something else, though, that comes into play. I mean, we are turning off the spigot of the sediment that is being introduced into the watershed, but that doesn't mean that the system automatically recovers. That is a process that takes decades, if not longer, to occur. These aren't valves from a wastewater treatment plant or some point source pollutant where you just arrest it and then conditions bounce back. For non-point source pollution, it takes some time. And so I just want to emphasize that this is a long-term process, a long-term recovery. And then another really effective strategy has been this accelerated wood recruitment. It's kind of a new restoration technique that we've really been pushing in Mendocino County. Starting in 2008 on the Conservation Fund's property, Jennifer led an effort to do some large wood recruitment. This is unanchored treatment of wood where you're wedging trees in between hard features across the landscape, or taking trees from upslope and bringing them down and placing them back into the system, kind of jump-starting the process that's been really postponed by all the removal of the riparian forest and all the removal of the in-stream wood. This is a photo that I took this year. It's a panoramic shot, so it's a little strange in its aspect, but this is the South Fork Garcia. And these are different pieces of wood that have been placed into the system And they're just there to function like wood naturally would for the million years before we got here, and that these fish evolved around. It's not engineered, anchored structures. This is unanchored and wedged pieces of wood. I know I haven't, we're not to the data and trends section, but earlier in the week I got kind of excited because we've been going to this reach for a number of years. And I thought, I wonder if we look at our thalweg profiles over these years, if we can see the signature of this wood. And so I put this together. If you, this is reach length along the top. I just isolated a 60 meter reach length that's associated with this right here. So the bottom of the reach is basically down here. The top of the reach is somewhere up here. And this is our depth of water. So the surface of the water would be kind of up at the top, and this is kind of your channel bed. So in 2009, this has always been kind of a riffle glide area. It's shallow. There's not much habitat. The deepest it looks like it is 35 centimeters. That's a foot, basically. Not great habitat. I'm going to point out this piece of wood right here because we're going to get back to that one. In 2012, it's basically the same. Nothing really changed. It kind of bounces around a little bit. Same for 2014. But in 2014, during the summer, is when this wood was put in. And so I wanted to go out and see whether we could track any change. And so in 2015, just after one season, and not even a big winter period, we had some significant development of new habitat. Quite a bit deeper pools, getting down into the 60 centimeter depth. So that's pretty rapid, pretty exciting, quick recovery action. Another way to look at this is to actually put on a snorkel and mask. That's our own Gil Falcone. This is that tree that we were looking at before. And to go underwater and see what it looks like. Down here, you have a nice little pool that's formed. And here's a nice school of coho salmon, one of the most endangered species that's in California right now. All the years that I've been surveying the Garcia, I've never seen so many coho salmon as I did this last year in this stretch of the river. I'm not saying it's just because of the wood, but I definitely don't think that it hurt. Look at these guys, they're gobbling on a little crayfish leg. There's a couple steelhead in there too, but it's primarily coho. Never seen a reach where there's more coho than steelhead too. It's really, like, really interesting. So I like that stuff. So that brings us to, are the conditions actually changing? Are we seeing a response from all of these different conservation and restoration actions over the years? So I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer now for the exciting stuff.
Thanks, Jonathan, and thanks for the opportunity to present today. I appreciate it. So I'm just going to go over I'm Jennifer Kara. I'm a freshwater ecologist with the Nature Conservancy. So I'm just going to go over the Garcia River monitoring program that we ended up adopting and implementing. We started working on the program in 2007, and the genesis of the project was really that there were kind of two strong needs for it. One was that the Water Board was really interested in a program to assess watershed conditions over time and assess progress towards meeting TMDL targets. Additionally, as Jonathan mentioned, the Garcia River Forest Project had begun, and there was a management plan that was developed for that program, for that project, that set specific objectives and goals with regard to restoration and management in the watershed and on that property specifically, and we needed a tool to kind of measure our progress towards those goals and use that information for adaptive management going forward. So we were hunting around for an off-the-shelf monitoring program that we could implement, or monitoring protocol we could implement, and the Environmental Monitoring and Assessment Program, or EMAP program, was our top candidate. It was developed by the Western Ecology Division of the EPA in Corvallis. It was the predecessor to SWAMP. SWAMP was built off of EMAP, so they share many of the same protocols and procedures. So some advantages of EMAP. It provides a huge amount of data that helps characterize physical, chemical, and biological conditions. And it's a true sampling protocol. So Jonathan mentioned that the TMDL action plan originally identified one sample site per subwatershed in the Garcia as the goal for tracking change over time. And it's tough to do if you have a sample size of one per subwatershed. So we really wanted a sampling protocol where we could randomly select a subset of sites throughout the watershed that could help characterize the condition over the entirety of the watershed. And EMAP really allowed us to do that. Other advantages, the parameters that are measured have known sampling precision estimates that were developed by the EPA. It's great at establishing baseline conditions and tracking changes over time. And it has been pretty helpful in helping to test relationships between watershed condition and land use activities like TMDL implementation, restoration actions, et cetera. And conveniently, it relates to most of the TMDL numeric targets, plus a lot more. So the EPA developed this paper where they were looking at the EMAP protocol's ability to detect changes in salmon-bearing watersheds in the Pacific Northwest, and they found that it takes about 30 to 50 sample reaches per area of interest to really adequately characterize conditions and to be able to detect changes over time. They found with that number of samples, they could detect changes of about 1 to 2% in their key indicators. It relies, as I mentioned, on a random sample design. It's a stratified random design. So there's the watershed is stratified by subwatershed, and then and random sites are selected within each of the subwatersheds. And your ability to detect trends using the method really increases over time. So the longer your sampling intervals are, the higher the power you have to detect trends in some of the key indicators. So these are, we worked with the EPA on our site selection. They ran their GERTS random probabilistic survey design sample, and they generated a number of sites for us to select from each of the subwatersheds. And we were really only limited by access. So most of the sites you can see are in the Garcia River Forest property here, which is in this kind of brown color. But we also have sites up here on the Myard Ranch, and we have sites down here on Mendocino Redwood Company's property and one site down here on BLM's property near the mouth. So the TMDL monitoring metrics that Jonathan showed are on the left here. We're covering with our program almost all of them. There's just a couple that aren't included. But we also get a whole bunch of other things that range from, you know, straight geomorphic measures to actual biology that we're getting along with this. So it incorporates, the monitoring program incorporates the TMDL numeric targets where they're feasible. There's not always a one-to-one match in methods, so we weren't able to use all of the numeric targets that were generated originally for the TMDL. But we were able to pull together some new numeric targets based on kind of the most recent science that was available. And some of those, I have some of them listed here. One of them is relative bed stability, which is kind of a measure of erosion and sediment transport in the stream, and I'll talk more about that later. The California Stream Conditions Index, or CSCI, is a new statewide biological indicator that's been developed using benthic macroinvertebrates or stream bugs. So we're in the process of completing a report on this effort. It should be ready by the end of the year. We've undergone our first round of peer review, and we'll have a second round of peer review towards the end of this month. So look forward to being able to present that to you soon. So I'm about to get into the results of what we found, but I just want to highlight, this is our little friend, the coho, and after I present each of the kind of sets of results, I'm going to bring it back to what does it mean to them. So you'll see this guy again a few times here. So a brief note on our data collection. I showed the map of the sites that we had selected. We have assessed baseline conditions at 80 reaches, and that data collection took place between 2007 and 2010. And then I'm also going to present some results on short-term trend analysis. We were interested to see for the sites that have been sampled in 20, 2007 and 8 and again in 2012, can we detect any changes in that relatively short time period in any of our key indicators? So in terms of actually implementing this thing, TNC hired a full-time summer crew for 2008 and 2012. The Water Board also conducted annual surveys in a number of reaches, 6 to 9 reaches, to add on to that. And I just want to highlight that this was not it wasn't a small effort and it wasn't inexpensive. It cost TNC for the full-time summer crews for 2008 and 2012, plus all of my time and my colleagues' time, and my time to do analysis and reporting, somewhere on the order of $450,000. And the board's contribution to that between 2007 and 2012 for the monitoring, plus Jonathan's time for analysis and reporting, is probably around $250,000. So it was a significant investment, but we feel like it was a really good investment. There are very few watersheds where this level of information is collected, and I think it can be an example that we can use to learn about kind of recovery in these types of systems more generally. So as I present the results, I'm going to bin them up into 3 categories. One are the Garcia River mainstem reaches, and then the other 2 are tributary categories, one that are low gradient, so less than 3% slope, more likely to be harboring salmonids, and then high gradient tributaries at greater than 3% slopes. So we've done some color coding here. The achievements of numeric targets that we've set are going to be highlighted in green, and trend analyses are either going to be blue if they're positive changes, or yellow if they're negative changes. And I am providing p-values or statistical indicators of statistical significance. It's basically, you know, if we've got a p-value here of 5%, it just means that we're about 95% confident that the observed changes are real. I am reporting a few, I'm going to report a few additional trends that have p-values that are a little bit higher than 5% too, just because I think they're interesting and probably true trends as well. So first category of results are around channel morphology. So the thaw wag is basically just the deepest point in the stream, and so we do longitudinal profiles where we walk up the stream and we're measuring stream depth from the water surface to the bottom of the stream. That's at the deepest point, that's the thaw wag. So we're tracking what mean thaw wag depths are, and you can see that the Garcia mainstem, no surprise, is deeper than the tributaries. And we're also tracking residual depths, and the nice thing about the residual depth is that it's flow independent. So thaw wag depth is you're going from water surface elevation to the bottom of the stream. That's going to vary from year to year depending on how much flow you have. The residual depth is if you just turned off if it was like a hose and you turned off the hose, where would that water sit? So it would basically be dammed up here by this riffle crest. This pool would remain full to here. So what's that depth from there to there? That's a flow independent measure, which is a really nice thing to use to track change over time because it's not dependent on flow. And what we saw there is that the Garcia mainstem, again, had greater residual depths than the tributaries. In terms of trends over time, so again, I just want to note this is a really short period of time that we're looking at trends over, but we did see some changes during that time period. We saw about a 22% increase in mean thaw wag depths in our high gradient tributaries, so those are those over 3%. In grade, and a 6% increase in variability of thaw wag depths in low gradient tributaries. So those would be the ones that would more than likely be housing salmonids. And the interesting thing about that is, so you can just think, Jonathan showed that nice graphic of what happened to the stream floor as the wood came in, right? It was relatively homogeneous in terms of stream depth, and then when they added the wood, you started to see a lot more heterogeneity in the stream depths, and that's what we've seen here. So the increase in variability of thaw wag depths is a really good thing because it means there's more complex habitat, more variation in the stream bed, and availability of different kinds of habitat features. Things that were not quite significant at 5%, but were pretty close. There was a 14% increase in thawweg depths in the low gradient tributaries as well, which is great, and an 11% increase in residual depths on low gradient tributaries. So that's that flow independent measure. So what does this look like to the coho? Tributary streams appear to be getting deeper and more complex in terms of habitat, so they're providing better rearing habitat, particularly in the summertime for salmon and steelhead. In terms of the substrate composition, so median particle size diameter, we've got relatively small particle sizes in the Garcia main stem and much larger particle sizes as you start moving upstream into the tributaries. Percent sand and fine, so those are particles that are 2 millimeters or smaller, are in high gradient tributaries and low gradient tributaries are meeting the biologically based numeric targets that we identified both for stream bugs as well as for aquatic vertebrates like salmonids. So the tributaries are in pretty good shape, generally speaking, with regard to fine sediment, which is good news. However, the Garcia main stem still has a bit of work to do and is exceeding numeric targets for both bugs and salmon at this point. So this is just kind of a visualization of that. So you can see over the watershed what we're talking about. The green dots are those that have sand and fines less than 13%, which have been identified as having minimum effects on aquatic vertebrates. And you can see, like, here's the North Fork of the Garcia, mostly green dots. Signal Creek, mostly green dots. Inman, mostly green dots. But as you come down the Garcia main stem here, we start picking up more and more red dots. And here's that low gradient reach that Jonathan was talking about earlier with mostly red dots. So in terms of trends over time for sediment, we saw a 15% increase in percent fine gravel, sand, and fine. So these are particles that are 16 millimeters and smaller. And that was in high gradient tributaries, so the headwater streams. And we saw a 22% decrease in the geometric mean substrate diameter in those same tributaries, which makes sense, right? You've got more small particle sizes, so it's going to drag the mean size of the particle in those areas down. We wanted to look at, you know, why might that be? And one of our hypotheses was that there's been a whole lot of sediment source control work that's been done in the watershed as a result of the TMDL over the last few years. And one of the things we thought was, well, maybe there was a short-term kind of input of sediments associated with all of that road upgrading and decommissioning that was happening in the watershed. When we tested that hypothesis, we had a relatively small sample size, but what we found were kind of inconclusive results. There was the means for this particular particle size, so 16 millimeters and smaller, were higher in the areas that had been treated under with erosion control measures than were the sites that had not been treated, but it was not a significant result. We had a p-value of about 0.2. So, you know, there's a 20% chance that our hypothesis that the increase in sediment was due to erosion control measures is wrong. So it indicates that may be what's going on, but it's not not definitive. So from a fish's perspective, the substrate composition in the tributaries have improved, but they continue to fluctuate and the main stem reaches are still impaired. So this is that relative bed stability I was talking about earlier. It's basically just a good measure of kind of the interplay between sediment supply and transport in the stream. It's a ratio of the average particle size divided by the average size of the mobile particle at a bank full flow. So if you have a really highly negative value, it means that you've got a really highly mobile stream. If you have a really highly positive value, it means you have an extremely stable and armored stream. Neither of those extremes are good. So good values would fall kind of in the middle, around zero, either a lightly negative or lightly positive value. So for all three of our categories, the baseline data measurements indicated that they were in the preferred range, which is a good thing. The over time, the RBS values in low gradient tributaries, where we're going to find our fish primarily, decreased, although they continued to be in the preferred range. The RBS values for high gradient tributaries decreased, shifting the scores to the upper end of the fair range. And you'll recall that that was where we actually, those streams were the ones where we saw that decrease in average particle size. Overall, we think that the changes in relative bed stability that we saw were probably driven by increases in shear stress that were related to increased flows between those two sampling times, and also a significant decrease in large wood availability, and I'll talk about that in a second. So when we looked at large wood debris and in-stream channel cover, we saw that there was a significant increase, and a rather large increase, 44%, in large wood volumes in the Garcia main stem. Conversely, we saw a decrease in large wood volumes in both of the tributaries, the low gradient and high gradient tributaries, and a decrease in wood-related and other natural cover in stream. So there's definitely transport of wood happening from the tributaries down into the main stem over this time period. We wanted to do a little bit of additional hypothesis testing and look at whether or not the large wood augmentation and restoration work that we've been doing that Jonathan talked about has increased the residual depths in the stream and has increased large wood volumes in those places where the treatments were done. And we did see significant results here. So we saw almost a 30% increase in mean residual depths in our treated areas versus the non-treated areas. And we saw a 225% increase in wood volumes following wood treatment in these streams. So from a fish's perspective, large wood and in-stream channel cover is still lacking, but restoration actions are increasing the volume and habitat available. I would just say that one of the takeaway messages for me looking at this information is that, you know, we've got a lot of large wood transport that's happening. We know that adding wood can help improve a number of these key metrics for fish. So we probably should be continuing to do large wood treatments over the short term at relatively regular intervals. So canopy cover and riparian structure. The baseline conditions for, so this is for canopy cover midstream on all of these creeks, is greatest in the tributaries, no surprise there. The average ranged from 76 to 90%, depending on what subwatershed you were in, and is the least in the main stem, so less than 50%. In terms of trends, we saw an increase in mean percent canopy midstream in the Garcia main stem, which is great news, and a 34% increase in total riparian canopy in the Garcia main stem. So that's like if you're standing in the middle and looking at the banks and looking at quantifying the canopy from the middle, looking out. And specifically, 22% increase in woody cover in that riparian zone on the main stem. So this is XCDN mid, which is the mid-channel canopy cover. And I have it in five categories here. The best are 80 to 100% and 60 to 80%. And you can see most of the tributaries are in that 80 to 100% category here. But when you start scooting down the main stem, we end up into some of these less preferable categories. You know, it is a much wider channel, so would naturally be expected to have lower canopy closure than some of these much narrower channels, tributary channels upstream. In terms of water temperature, we took spot water temperature measurements at each of our sampling locations, but that's not really data that's sufficient to look at trends over time. So in addition, we have water temperature probes or hobos that we place yearly throughout the watershed. And so this information is derived from those hobo probes. So I used the raw temperature data and calculated maximum weekly maximum temperatures, or MWMT, and compared that information to thresholds that have been established for the North Coast. One is Catherine Carter of your staff's work. So when we look at the maximum weekly maximum temperatures on the Garcia main stem, they exceed numeric targets established by Catherine Carter, which is 16 degrees C or less, which constitutes optimal rearing habitat for coho salmon. So not optimal conditions in the main stem thermally right now. Temperatures on the tributaries, however, are much better. There are a number of tributaries that are currently meeting the numeric targets. The North Fork Garcia, Signal Creek, Graphite Creek, and Olson Gulch are examples of ones that are meeting the 16 degrees C target for optimal rearing habitat. We also looked at another threshold, which was just for presence of coho salmon, which is based on Hart Welsh's work. And that's a little bit higher temperature threshold of 18 degrees C. And again, the main stem reaches exceed that target, but most of the tributaries are currently meeting the numeric target. this is just a map of that. I'll skip over it. So the fish are thinking water temperatures are pretty high in the main stem and some tributaries, but canopy cover is definitely improving, and that should help temperature conditions over time. So what do the bugs say? The low gradient tributaries and the high gradient tributaries both met numeric targets for CSCI and are considered likely intact under that that framework. The Garcia main stem reaches had scores that did not meet the numeric targets. They fell within the upper end of the likely altered condition of CSCI. And our CSCI scores were pretty much the same between sampling periods. So what does that look like? I have four categories here. The green is that likely intact condition. Yellow is possibly altered. Orange is likely altered, and red is very likely altered. And you can see, again, most of the tributaries are in the green category. But when we get down here to the main stem, we start to see more orange and yellow as we move downstream. In terms of Salmonid distribution, this is mostly information from Sean Gallagher's work for the California Department of Fish and Game, where they're tracking adult Salmonid escapement numbers over time. And what we're seeing is that Salmonid spawning and rearing is happening widely in the watershed, but in really small numbers still. Coho salmon are maintaining all three of their age class cohorts. And steelhead are widely distributed throughout the watershed. Chinook have been found in several years in small numbers in the main stem of the Garcia, and pink salmon are occasionally found in the lower Garcia spawning there. But to give you a sense of the numbers, Sean's numbers for adult estimates of returning spawners over the last 6 or 7 years range from like 8 to 211 for coho. The recovery target's about 3,700 fish. For steelhead, it ranges from like 25 to 700, over almost 800 fish. The recovery target's 3,200. So still very depressed numbers. This is a graphic of the distribution based on our snorkel survey work. The pink dots are sites where we found coho and steelhead juveniles present. The yellow are just steelhead present, and the gray were no salmonids present. So you can see that even coho are relatively well distributed throughout the watershed, just present in very small numbers. So from a fish's perspective, the tributaries are healthy according to the bugs. The salmon and trout are found in almost every sub-watershed, but just in pretty low numbers at this point. And I'd like to turn it back over to Jonathan to conclude.
Thank you, Jennifer. So just to summarize, the Garcia main stem, it still needs more time to recover. We're going in the right direction, but it's a longer period that's going to be required for that to finally reach a more stable condition. We still have excess sediment that's being vacated. Pools and residual depths are lacking. The relative bed stability is nearly meeting those targets, the preferred range, but we're still lacking wood. Canopy cover, however, is looking like it's improving. It's going in the right direction, although our temperatures are still too high. And our benthic macroinvertebrate populations are not meeting the targets. However, we're still finding some salmonids throughout the main stem of the Garcia. Lower numbers than ideal. I'm sure under a healthier condition, we would see even larger numbers. The tributaries, however, are improving and or meeting targets. Thalweed depths and variability are increasing. Residual depths are increasing. Substrate composition is already meeting the targets for that smaller substrate class, the percent sand and fines. Relative bed stability is meeting targets. Our canopy cover and temperatures are improving, are already meeting targets in some subwatersheds. Large wood restoration is increasing that habitat that's needed. One thing that we didn't talk about is overwinter survival, which is a really significant issue for juvenile salmonids in the coast range, where wood provided sort of a surrogate for an off-channel like floodplain kind of refuge situation, where wood is that alternative during those highest flows. And so by putting in more wood, we're increasing that habitat and that overwinter survival. Benthic macroinvertebrates are already meeting targets. They're looking good. And we have a wide distribution of salmonid spawning and rearing. It makes sense logically. These tributaries are smaller, slightly steeper. They're the first things to recover from all the impairments of the past. If you reflect back when I showed that map of the Fish and Wildlife surveys from 1966, all the tributaries were in the worst shape at that point, even more so than the main stem was. But what we're seeing is kind of a transference of the cumulative effects of the past moving from the tributaries downstream into that aggraded stream channel onto the main stem, and we're continuing to move that out over time. A couple take-home messages that I wanted to present. Earlier I said that the Garcia River is similar to a lot of our North Coast watersheds, and that has a lot to do with the aspect, the historical aspect, land use impacts, kind of the beneficial uses that we're trying to protect. So there's a lot of similarities. And that impairment, though, it took a long time to occur. I went back to 1860 and brought you to today, so over 160 years of history influencing the conditions out there. And similarly, that recovery is going to take a long time to occur, so decadal or longer time scale. Conservation and restoration actions are working, including the TMDL, but natural factors are the primary driver of recovery. You know, we're doing what we can to reduce the sediment introduction. We're turning off that spigot of sediment. We're protecting riparian zones. We're allowing trees to grow back. And we're eventually, those trees will start recruiting naturally. But it's really up to the watershed. We need big flows to continue to come and flush out a lot of the excess sediment. We need the riparian forest to grow back. Can't force them to grow back any faster than they are. So we need, we need more time, and we need, continued effort to help assist that recovery. And like I mentioned, the implementation of the TMDL is a success, and that is really attributed to really strong partnerships. That's partnerships with landowners, partnerships with RCD, partnerships with our nonprofit environmental organizations. It's a pretty big community effort to try and recover a watershed. It's not something that you just do independently. And there's been a really large outlay of private and public investments, probably over $7.5 million, up to $10 million, somewhere in that range, for sediment control efforts so far. That includes, we have $2.5 million worth of 319H grants that we've been administering. Fish and Wildlife has all sorts of grants through the Fisheries Restoration Grant Program. There's a lot of landowners that are just contributing, taking care of their land and hiring consultants and implementing the work. So it's a significant outlay to try and control all this pollution also, and improve the landscape. It's worthwhile. We think this is the way to do it. Tracking that recovery also requires a really robust, scientifically based and adaptable management or monitoring plan that you have to sustain over a long period of time. We showed you a really short glimpse into a period from the 2007 to 2012 range. Ironically, the largest storm events to affect the Garcia happened right before we even started the monitoring program. 2006, we were during the winter of 2006, we, I think, hit 32,000 cubic feet per second at one point. Really big storms came through. And so we still haven't had big events like that since then. We've had a couple periodic ones in 2012, but we need more. There needs to be more time. You need to sustain this for a longer time horizon to be able to pick up the signature and a long-term trend. The Garcia River Management Monitoring Program allows us to evaluate whether some of those conservation and restoration practices are working, and therefore it's a surrogate for other watershed recovery actions elsewhere. But it would be really challenging to replicate this in other watersheds. We were very fortunate to have participating landowners that were supportive of us doing this. Having the Nature Conservancy at our side as a primary partner in implementing this, but it'd be really difficult for us to replicate the same thing. So this is sort of a, if we believe that if conservation and restoration actions in the Garcia are helping facilitate that recovery in the Garcia, it would likely be the same in other watersheds. Brings us back to our mission statement. And I think that, you know, this is a really good example. The Garcia experience is a really good example of the implementation of this mission statement. Effective regulation, I've been thinking about that a lot for a number of years. I learned a lot by working in this watershed about what it means to effectively implement a program like that. And a couple of years ago, I mentioned that I strongly believe that in addition to effective regulation, advocacy is also a really good policy. And we need to continue to support landowners to try and move these things forward. It's an important process. And it takes a community to move this forward. So strong partnerships. If it weren't for those strong partnerships with these landowners, with these other environmental organizations and RCDs, it would be a much, much more difficult process to achieve. So with that, we conclude. If you have any questions.
Board members, and I'll start with Valerie. And
well, thanks, guys. That was very exciting. And it seems like you have a winning combination when it comes to enthusiasm and then also some sort of scientific meticulous patience in, you know, understanding that even though it's all very exciting, gotta wait to see what the end game is. Speaking of end game, in terms of, you mentioned $2.5 million in 319H funds invested, and I'm sure that's just part of the investment in some of the restorative actions. And you also mentioned that natural factors are a primary driver of the recovery and that these restorative actions are, you know, sort of a part that helps the natural factors. So how do you, given how long it might take to see the influence of natural factors over time, do you have a plan for when you decide when there's been enough investment in the restorative actions and when you can sit back and wait and you know, kind of let nature take its course in partnership with the restoration that's occurred?
Sure, I'll answer that. So two different things. As far as the investment in the sediment control side of things, we're pretty comfortable, I think, with where we're at with participation in the TMDL. There's a lot of work still being done. There's a lot of erosion control plans that are partially completed, you know, halfway through their implementation. So there is going to have to be a continued investment, both private and public, for several years to come to finalize those. as far as something that Jennifer touched on, as far as like large wood recruitment and different restoration actions, until the like system kind of gets back towards a more natural self-recruiting, self-healing process where the riparian forests are old enough and starting to introduce wood on their own, I think we're gonna continue to have to do that for a while. So it's gonna kind of dual approach on those two things.
And then one follow-up question about the level of comfort with participation in the TMDL. 80% is very impressive, but that seems to imply that 20% of the watershed is not participating. And so what's going on there? Are those properties that don't have any problems that need to be addressed? Are they sure. Such small landowners you can't get everyone, capture everyone in the net? What's that 20%?
It's primarily the latter. The TMDL was geared towards the largest landowners, ultimately recognizing limitations on our staffing ability and just the efficiency of doing a program like this. On the books, I think there's close to 400 individual landowners identified across the ownership, across the watershed, and the bulk of those 300, I think, are less than 100 acres. Mm-hmm. And so the ability for us to work directly with every individual one is just not very practical, really. And so, like, my role in particular, having moved outside of the Garcia, I sustain about a 25% of my time still overseeing implementation of the program, of the TMDL and the monitoring program. But we're kind of bringing the experience from the Garcia elsewhere and expanding that to Mendocino County and other parts of the region to try and promote other recovery, similar like recovery actions in other watersheds that are in as much need as the Garcia. So recognizing our limitations staffing-wise, we think that that's a good approach.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks, guys.
The question, Jennifer, you talked a little bit on your salmonid distribution slide. You talked about, you know, kind of the abundance in distribution, but had mentioned that was part of a CDFW tracking for part of their escapement. What's going on with out-migration? How are those numbers?
That would be...
We can get fish up and we can give them a good home, but are we successful at getting them out?
That would be great information to have. Right now, the program that Sean Gallagher is running on the Mendocino Coast is really, the goal of the program is to track adult returns over time regionally. So that's where he's kind of focused his effort. They have three watersheds within the range of Mendocino County Coast where they're actually what they call full life cycle monitoring stations. And so in those three watersheds, they're not only tracking the number of adults that are coming back to spawn, they have out migrant traps where they're trapping the juveniles as well. The Garcia is not one of those three life cycle monitoring stations. So there is no juvenile out migrant trapping that's happening in the Garcia right now. So I can't answer that question, unfortunately. I wish we could.
Well, I think it's highly suggestive that those numbers are going up based on the physical changes that you're seeing and what's happening out there. So I think we're obviously heading in the right direction. So thanks for
that. I hope so.
Yeah, right. Keep our fingers crossed. And then secondly, about some of that large wood seeding that you're doing with the placements that have been, you know, just kind of like naturally wedging things in and no engineering, no cabling, no anchoring or anything like that, which is fine. Have you seen any additional wood recruitment on that? You know, there's going to be smaller woody debris that comes down and gets trapped and racked up in that, and eventually those kind of serves as nodes or aggregate locations for more wood to get in there and potentially more stuff to jam up. Are those, have they been in long enough for you to see a change yet, or are they, you know, what's the longevity? Are they, you know, during higher flows, are they just kind of rafting up and floating out? Or I would imagine there's some loss, but I would imagine that you're probably either at a, probably at a net gain for overall wood recruitment.
Yeah, so we did kind of separate from the EMAP program, because the EMAP sites were randomly selected, some of them fell within areas that we'd done wood treatment, but most of them didn't. And so to actually get at what you're asking, we did targeted monitoring in the areas of treatment and tracked those variables over time. And we did see really significant increases in wood volumes and small wood availability as well and racking and that sort of thing. So the large wood that we placed deepened the channel where it was placed, increased wood volumes where it was placed, or pool volumes, excuse me, where it was placed, increased the amount of small material that was racking. Yeah, so we did see all of those kinds of positive changes associated with the large wood treatments. And we had pretty high retention rates. So we tagged all of our wood pieces with uniquely numbered tags. We put 4 tags per piece because they, when they move it, you never know where the tag's going to end up. And we're tracking that over time. And, you know, we're having, and for the most part, I think the last survey that we did was in 2013. We actually need to go back and re-find all those pieces again. But depending on the location, we had retention rates in that, in between treatment and our last survey point, which was, you know, 5 or 6 years or so, of between about, I think it's 77% was the lowest, and up to like 95% retention of the pieces that we placed. But, you know, as Jonathan mentioned, during that time period, we didn't really experience much over a bank full flow. So when we start getting bigger storm events, I would expect more mobility to be happening.
Sure, sure. And I mean, you'll get to a threshold where it accumulates so much that, you know, you'll be growing a site and more wood, but then finally it becomes more of a hydraulic impediment and it's going to break itself free, but hopefully sends it downstream to yet another site that you've seeded and it'll just rack up there. So it's still in the system, but whether it stays, whether it parks itself or goes on out, to be seen. Thank you.
Board Member Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first off, I want to thank you two for coming here today. This is data that I've been looking forward to for a long time. And it really is, I for one wasn't here when the Garcia TMDL was adopted. It's always been kind of put up as the Cadillac version of TMDL. And, you know, looking at the amount of effort in this watershed, the amount of partnerships for sure that have happened here, I think it's important to reflect on, because it shows what's actually possible and actually what actually how it lends itself as an example for kind of all pieces of this, whether it be data-driven assessment, so that we have, it's a data, it's probably, like you said, Jennifer, I believe that this is one of the higher or probably more data-rich watersheds as far as recovery assessment goes. Tracking now, I assume that continues. At the same time, Jonathan, I give you huge credit in your work, and that, you know, when I first talked to you about the Garcia, you were kind of captured in that watershed, and yet you've grown out and taken pieces and parts of this out into the coast, right, into the Mendocino restoration work and some of the permitting that's out there. And it really does show what's possible. At the same time, you know, if this is a Cadillac, we can't bring a Cadillac everywhere, right, based on limitations and that are real out there. And so let's take it back to then the Toyota model. And I love Toyotas, by the way. They're not a cheap, but they're really great, right? They get you there. And the thing is, my question is then there's a number of coastal tribs out here that are just like this, that have this same history. And you alluded to that, Jonathan, whether it be the Guala or whether it be 10 Mile or some of the others that are out here. We have very, very many of those, I believe, have technical TMDLs on them. So they really don't have their EPA TMDLs that don't have an implementation plan other than our implementing programs. So my real question is then is, and you brought this up, if this is a surrogate, and we're not going to take a Cadillac everywhere, and we're going to take a Toyota because a Toyota will get you there, then what parts of this then are, what do we, and by the way, I recognize that this is 5 to 7 years of data, depending on how you look at it, right, that you're presenting here. I know that this continues to today, but your data set as presented today is 2007 to 12. What pieces and parts then do you take of this to take into other watersheds that surely need that kind of assessment, that kind of work as well? And what is that lesson learned? How do you take this out and go bigger and apply this to other watersheds?
Just to clarify, are you speaking to the implementation of the TMDL and the recovery actions or the monitoring program or both?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, and I ask that because, again, I'm looking at it. I applaud this work. I applaud the work of everybody that's been involved in this, from the landowners on up, from the regulatory on down, from the partnerships. And yet, again, I see watersheds out here, especially some of the coastal tribs, that surely need this as well. And so my question is, how then do you take this, not you, but how is this taken then as a model, the best parts of this model, maybe the most key parts to this model? to take and learn from this and truly use it as a surrogate.
Sure.
And scale it up or down.
Well, speaking to the TMDL implementation first, the Toyota model, I would say, is already being implemented through a lot of our programs. I mean, the basics of what we're doing in the Garcia, pollution control, riparian protections, those are infused in our timber permits, in our, you know, our cannabis program, in all of these different models that we're currently implementing in these watersheds where we don't have an implementation plan. So the basics of what we're going to be doing elsewhere is kind of the same. If you structure it similar to the Garcia TMDL, you could take that approach, and that may transfer well into another watershed. But I don't think that we are waiting per se for actions to begin in these other areas. We are doing our best across our programs to kind of do the same thing: pollution control, riparian protections, and focus on committing towards restoration, in-stream restoration actions. So whether you would take the exact TMDL for the Garcia and apply it in the Gualala or the Noyo or elsewhere, it's another experiment in an approach that we don't have a lot of different examples to compare and contrast to. So it's kind of a vague answer intentionally.
It's okay.
But if you understand what I'm kind of saying, I think we're heading in that direction already. I think that Garcia is a good model for just doing pollution control and that transferring to other areas.
Yeah, it's not a mystery, right, that some of the ingredients of restoration or recovery then become kind of your standard palette, right?
Yeah.
Just as you expressed. And at the same time, I fully recognize that the some of the programs, especially that grew out of here, that this became an example. It is an example. And I agree with you that this permeates into other permits, right? Mm-hmm. This is I agree that it's in timber. Timber is forest practice rules, ASP, and TNI, and all that other things out there. I guess at the same time, Jonathan, I look at this and think, okay, because again, I'm thinking about, as you said, you know, the Noyo, especially the Gualala. I look at the Gualala. I used to fish the Gualala quite a lot, and the Gualala is beautiful, parts of it. It's also has many of these same historical land use issues that happened here. It has the same legacy, and it has some of the same impairments.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess what I'm asking, too, is then this is a great model. It'd be great to take this model everywhere. But how many square miles is this watershed, by the way?
112
square miles. And at the same time, I think you said about $10 million worth of investment has gone into this, right?
Up to, yeah.
So if we scale it then or take it into watersheds, that $10 million per 100, call it 100 square miles, just for simple math here, right, is that's a pretty high cost.
Mm-hmm.
And is that sustainable? It's probably not, given the demands and economics that are out here. I'm not saying that it's impossible. And it's maybe not necessary. And I guess I'm asking then, is there a look to this? Is there thoughts then to take the best parts of some of this? And I know it's already happening, by the way, and refine this. The work that's done here is extraordinary. The information is extraordinary. On a level that we don't see. But maybe we don't need to see that and refine it to key parameters. Some of the key surveys, time, and especially a data-driven set like what you guys have now, you guys can look at trends. You could use that as predictive trends, and you could use it as assessment of those land use and use it as an example. That's the best part of this.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, I'm really grateful. I think this is an excellent example, and it's a shining example, actually, of that effort of what happened here and what is happening as a result, and take the best parts of that, which are already happening, and I fully acknowledge that, mm-hmm. and take it elsewhere, take that show on the road.
Yeah, I think that's embodied also in things like our watershed stewardship framework that we're implementing in other watersheds, inserting ourselves, building up those partnerships with other people to kind of implement this forward in other areas where we don't have the same implementation plan. But the ingredients, as you mentioned, are essentially the same.
They are.
So yes. Whether you call it watershed stewardship, whether you call it a general waste discharge requirement,
yeah,
TMDL implementation, it's a lot of the same ingredients.
Well, this is very good work. by everyone involved. I want to thank you both personally. And as far as other landowners, I know, you know, that there's a ton of landowners and partners here that, you know, I'd like to acknowledge as well. One very last request is that when that report gets published, can you let us know? Can you distribute that, please, and make sure that board members just get noticed? I'd really like to kind of dive in that and check it out.
Definitely.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
I had some questions. Usually a watershed this size, there will be some direct spring discharges, and that tends to create cold water refusion. Those tend to be considered high target areas for restoration because of and so have you identified those, or have you found any on this particular watershed?
Yeah, so there's been some mapping of spring features that's been done, but not a lot. But we've really learned a lot about that from our temperature data, from the hobo loggers that we've been placing on a yearly basis since 2006. You can really see in that temperature data certain streams that are pretty impervious to rising air temperatures, and then, you know, one can assume are being largely fed by spring and groundwater that's keeping that water relatively cool and consistently cool. And those areas have been primary areas where we've targeted restoration efforts. So Signal Creek is one of those, is a good example of that. Really good, cool, consistent water temperatures. And it's been one of the places we've focused our large wood restoration efforts.
Because usually fish will migrate in a hot environment to where it's cold and more desirable. My next question for you is, you mentioned canopy. Canopy relates to temperature, and you sort of got into it. To what extent are you correlating that with ambient air temperature? Because there's always an argument, especially per square acre of watershed, the larger it is, the more it's influenced by ambient temperature and the less by canopy. Are you finding that relationship, or are you cross-correlating the data to ambient temperature?
We haven't gotten into that level of analysis with canopy and temperature yet. We worked with Stillwater Sciences on, they have a modeling program that they use called Basin Temp, which helps assess, it models increases in, you can model increases in canopy cover and look at how that might impact water temperatures in various places. And what we saw when we did that work with them was that there was significant opportunity to improve temperatures in a number of the tributaries with increasing canopy and a lot less in the main stem.
Right. Well, the main stem is wider, so there'll be... you mentioned that there are five or three watersheds that are models for the fish population. Have you correlated your counts to those so you can establish whether that's a good representative model for you or not? In other words, if your numbers go down, are they going down in the other three model watersheds the same sense of proportion, although you got such a small number of fish, you know, three fish could affect the results. But are you correlating to make sure that's a good model example?
Yeah, so the California Department of Fish and Wildlife does look at those numbers, and we've looked at them across the number of watersheds where they're collecting that kind of information. And it does, the trends do tend to be regional. So when you have a really good escapement year with a lot of adults coming back to spawn, it tends to be kind of a regional trend where you see larger numbers in all of the watersheds where the sampling is happening. At the same, I mean, a lot of it's related to marine survival, actually. So marine survival is very low now, and probably really low compared to historical marine survival numbers. And that's in part due to historical fishing issues and also to climate change and upwelling patterns and, you know, kind of larger global weather patterns and things like that.
But, you know, a shortcut to look at the marine would be to take Pacific Coast fisheries management data, and you know they go, they're very big, Klamath, and they're very big, then Sacramento. But if all of those are down plus down near watershed, then that's a strongly indicates marine as opposed to variations. And then have you taken any DNA of the fish at all? There's starting to be increasing studies of whether there's any DNA in the different fish populations.
The National Marine Fisheries Service, actually, we encountered a group of scientists this last year that we're collecting DNA from the South Fork, actually, where those images were taken. That and they've been doing that. There's some initial thoughts on perhaps starting a Mendocino Coast kind of broodstock program similar to what is happening in the Russian River. And so we've been coordinating a bit with National Marine Fisheries Service on kind of locations of different where the animals are found in the watershed in advance of what could be a new broodstock program. But we don't ourselves collect the DNA.
No, I understand. Yeah, yeah. But if someone's doing it, that's... Yeah. We can all work together, you know.
Yeah, and that's pretty critical because, you know, as I said, there's really small numbers in some years. And so in addition to marine survival issues and freshwater survival issues, you've also got potential population bottleneck and genetic issues, right? When you get down to such a small population size, you could be having impediments to recovery just based on the actual size of the population and lack of genetic diversity. So consideration of a broodstock program for Mendocino Coast would be a good thing. I think there's a number of streams like the Garcia and others that have really small populations that limitations to recovery. We could do a lot to increase habitat availability, and yet those populations wouldn't maybe expand out and take advantage of all the habitat that's available because of potential genetic bottlenecks.
And then one last question. It seems to me you've been working on best management practices for fine sediment. Have you taken a look at sediment in versus sediment out and primarily focusing on how much sediment is being taken out of the system each year and what those relationships are?
There's several older studies that were done associated with Garcia River Gravel Management Plan. I can't remember what year it was done. I think Phil Williams and Associates did a kind of annual sediment budget to look at that. But we haven't had anything since then. That was mid-90s kind of period. So currently, no.
Okay. Well, I just want to thank you for your project, and we'll go down the board.
Thank you very much for that report and presentation. Appreciate it. A lot of information. So any good project, an effective project, depends on good targets. So you need to know where you're going. So you mentioned that a lot of the targets or some of the targets in the TMDL have come and gone and are out of fashion. I also listened to a very high expectation of the fish returns. So based on adaptive management, all the climate change, lessons learned, what are we going to do to change those targets from what we've learned and what's more realistic so that the activities that we spend $10 million on are actually the right activities to the right goals?
Yeah, so I mentioned kind of adaptively managing the monitoring approach. And as technology advances, you know, it's hard to predict what's the next iPhone going to be, you know, in 10 years. What is the next thing around the corner? And certain elements of the numeric targets and parameters that were used at that time brought into the TMDL action plan were kind of the best at that point. But there was, there was a need to identify more precise measures. And so I don't have a real specific answer, except we're kind of using what the most current evolving science is supporting of what we should be using, what we should be looking at for what those targets are. But unfortunately, I can't totally predict out into the future if those will then be superseded. I'm thinking back, like, when the TMDL was adopted, for instance, we weren't even using GPS. That was like military science. And now every phone has a little GPS on it. And I remember when we first got a GPS here, it was this backpack with a big umbrella. It was this primitive lunar lander looking thing. So I guess I'm saying that because, there's there's an inherent vulnerability in the fact that we can't predict where technology will take us down the road. LIDAR has come onto the scene since the TMDL was adopted. Things have totally changed with the way we do remote sensing, and there may be something around the corner that is even more efficient, more effective. But the science supports the parameters we are using currently as being ability to detect a positive change over time. And the expectation is that achieving those targets will benefit the species that we're trying to support.
I guess my question is more of, are we sure those targets are correct? Have we gone back to review those? Do we have any dates set to say, let's open that up, let's look at them, let's have a discussion whether they're realistic? I mean, 3,200 fish is a lot of fish to come back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is that realistic? And is, right. is you know, so that we're doing the right things and we don't have goals out there so far that they're unattainable.
Yeah, and I think those questions in particular are really specific to our state and federal wildlife agencies that are setting those targets. They're in charge of doing those intrinsic potential models to identify what a, you know, sustainable, healthy population size is. And so that falls outside of our realm. We partner with them kind of when they're setting those and introducing a lot of, you know, the water board's needs and interests into their kind of analyses, but we're not in charge of that directly.
But there's no plan to update the TMDL goals?
There isn't specifically right now.
Is that something that the board can push for?
Yes.
So as part of the triennial review process, which is every 3 years we do an exercise, it's essentially a work planning exercise for consideration of revisions to things that are in our basin plan. And that is the opportunity for the board. Well, first of all, staff does a review of potential basin plan amendment projects and comes to the board with recommendations. And then the board has an opportunity ultimately to approve staff's recommendation or make revisions as necessary. So we last completed the triennial review in 2014. And so next calendar year is when we'll be going through the exercise again. And when we do that, TMDL projects that have an action plan in the basin plan are absolutely on the table for projects to consider. With that said, I'd say I don't see any need to revisit the Garcia TMDL. I think what we're doing is working, and we just need to continue it. But with that said, we'll absolutely take a look at all of the basin plan and come to the board with recommendations next year.
At the risk of speaking for someone else, I thought Kelly's question was a little deeper than that. It's not a priority which basin plan to review or not. Do we have some type of systematic review of the goals that we have in the different watersheds, whether they're realistic or not, based upon the actual implementation of the plan? And when you say if they're working, the question is, if they are working, are the goals still realistic or are they not working? So I thought it was a little deeper question. Maybe I'm wrong, but.
No, that's true. If we're using public money, we need to make sure we're putting it to tasks that are higher priority or that are realistic. If we have an unrealistic goal and we're spending a lot of money chasing down something that's unattainable, that's not good use of public funds. So I was just wondering, you know, just what the process was and when we could go back. And because you just said that a lot of these goals have gone out of fashion. And we have climate change and we have ocean changes and a lot of stuff we've learned along the way that I would think that we need to go back, look at, and make sure that we're efficient and effectively using the public's money.
I would just have a point of clarification, which is that the fish numbers are not a goal under our numeric target under the TMDL. As Jonathan said, they're a recovery goal under the National Marine Fisheries Service and California Department of Fish and Wildlife. So they're the ones who are setting those goals. And I would say that it's not that the actual like categories of targets that were selected for the TMDL are have gone out of fashion or are not valuable. We actually measured the same things. We just the goals that the specific numeric goals that were set initially for the TMDL were dependent on methods that don't easily lend themselves to sampling, to a random sample where you can characterize an entirety of a watershed. And so we basically just took those really good objectives that were developed and put them into a framework that would allow us to sample. So we're using the same things. We're using the same variables, basically. We're just measuring them slightly differently. And because we're measuring them slightly differently in this way that allows us to kind of characterize the whole watershed, we had to set slightly different numeric targets. So it's not that that was bad work or anything like that. It was great work. The work that was identified the key variables that need to be tracked over time. And I don't think those are going to change. I don't think they should change. But it was just kind of a change to the way that we're measuring them to make it more repeatable over time, if that makes sense.
Board Member Goodstein? Okay. Well, I want to thank you for the presentation. It's really exciting to review the Garcia and the progress being made, and I think your data will be very helpful for us being more efficient in the future to protect fish and wildlife and water quality. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to have a break after this, but I forgot one thing. I did want to note the passing of Jerry Partain, former director of what's now Cal Fire. And he was one of the deeper thinkers I think we've ever had on how you coordinate forestry with Cal Fish and Game and with water quality. I was able to attend his funeral. And the other was Ray Pert, former Humboldt County supervisor, who showed that you can be one of the nicest human beings in the world and still effective. And he was able to bring people together every place he went, no matter how far apart they went, and we will lose his advocacy for fish and environmental restoration. So with that, we'll have is 10 minutes good enough for the board members? Okay, we'll have a 10-minute recess.